There is this intrinsic fear of leaders for not having a clear answer to a dilemma. So another behavioral scientist, but I learned a lot from the behavioral scientists in my team, that we need to accept and look at the context where these discussions are taking place. Are we doing enough that the people are willing to share their dilemmas? Because even if we can't promise them a solution, we can listen, we can debate, we can balance the pros and cons of a difficult decision.
Welcome to the Leading Transformational Change podcast. Our passion is to help you lead and develop organizations with a remarkably healthy culture that can positively impact all of its stakeholders. Every other Thursday, we drop hour-long conversations with world-leading researchers and experts on culture, ethics, change, and leadership. My name is Tobias Sturesson, and I'm your host and the co-founder of Arts Management. What does it look like to integrate ethics, build trust, and develop responsible and values-driven leadership in a truly global company? Klaus Moosmeyer knows. He's the Chief Ethics, Risk and Compliance Officer and a member of the Executive Committee at Novartis, one of the world's largest pharmaceutical companies operating in over 150 countries. When developing medicines for, among other things, the treatment of cancer and cardiovascular disease, building stakeholder trust is absolutely critical. Yet, as Klaus shares, it's something the pharmaceutical industry has at times failed at with some dire consequences. In this podcast episode, I have a wide-ranging conversation with Klaus Moosmeyer about culture, leadership, and ethics. Klaus shares the journey of creating their code of ethics, what he's been learning from behavioral science, the danger of silos, and why he's taken an integrative approach, bringing together ethics, risk, and compliance. We discuss why humble leadership is critical to avoid silence, where there will always be pressure in companies, and how we can effectively address the tensions that pressure creates. I truly appreciated Klaus's insights and extensive experience, as well as his curiosity and just refreshing willingness to admit that he doesn't have all the answers. Klaus is a lawyer by trade, and before Novartis, he spent 18 years at Siemens. Before we jump into our conversation, Klaus several times mentions our free white paper, Six Vital Steps to Leading Lasting Culture Change and Making Values Matter. I've been so grateful to hear so many leaders, including HR and ethics and compliance professionals, who have found this resource truly helpful, and some of them have shared it with their management teams. You can download your own copy for free at heartmanagement.org/resources, heartmanagement.org/resources. But now, without further ado, let's jump into this fascinating conversation with Klaus Moosmeyer. Klaus, it is such a privilege to have you on the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you, Tobias, and looking forward to our dialogue.
Me too. And of course, Novartis is a genuinely global company. I mean, there are a lot of companies that would call themselves global, but you are a truly global company operating in over 150 countries and serving about 100 million patients with Novartis medicine. And I wanted to start by asking you, what does it mean to you to truly see business as a part of society, especially in a company that I'm thinking belongs to so many different cultural contexts and communities?
It's a privilege and it's a responsibility. And you feel this if you talk, especially to our research and development colleagues in the company, to serve nearly 300 million patients across the globe with innovative medicines. This is something that fills them with pride. On the other hand, as you know, the pharmaceutical companies are, for good reasons, also under high scrutiny. And why? Because we are the industry which is the closest you can be as an industry to life and health of people. So it's both. It's a huge privilege. It's a huge responsibility. It's full. I'm sure we talk about this, of ethical dilemmas. because we are so close to life and health, and it requires courage and honesty to raise these topics as well.
That is so, so true. And when you think about trust, when we think about what it means to be a trusted company, what is trust to you? And what are some components that you've seen in your work at Novartis are really key to building and sustaining that trust?
Look, when we moved away from our code of conduct towards the code of ethics, we debated this issue of trust with our employees in a crowdsourcing way. And this gave me a lot of reflection, gave thousands of colleagues a lot of reflection about trust, the elements. And we said, how do we describe trust? What are the elements of trust? And we came basically forward with four guiding principles. We said it's about honesty. It's about accountability. It's to be open-minded, because you only trust someone if someone is listening, is open-minded. But it's also to be bold, to speak up if you need to speak up, which, as we know, it's not easy. It depends on the context. So it's open, being open-minded, honesty, being bold, being accountable. And this can form a longer lasting trust.
Really helpful. And I wanted to ask you, and of course, you just have to talk about what you can talk about, but is there an instance where you feel, or an example of an instance where you see, okay, we did a really good job of building trust here, and maybe an instance where you felt we screwed it up?
I would say, as an industry overall, we were in the 70s and 80s to be maybe the most highly regarded industry at our world. And at least before the pandemic, it changed a little bit after COVID, during COVID, we were very low in the rankings of trust. So what happens? Definitely, I would say in the past, the industry screwed up because we were not able to explain why we are here, why innovation is important, why pharma pricing is as it is, how do we create access. And of course, the industry made mistakes in the relationship towards especially healthcare professionals. But I see also beyond our company, I mean, a willingness to showcase more, to be more open-minded, to bring, and maybe one specific eternal ethical topic better to the discussion. Let's take the eternal ethical topic of dilemma of animal testing. Whatever you do, you can't avoid this, but you need it for the current scientific standards to advance innovation. So how do you deal with such a dilemma? And I think now we, at least what I see, is the industry, the companies are more open to put these dilemmas on the table, have a public dialogue, explain what we do to reduce, refine, replace animals. That's one very practical topic. And I think we need to continue this transparency, as because we are part of society. We are part of society.
Of course, an important aspect of that, and when we talk about dilemmas, and I really like this picture of thinking that we actually have a conversation also with the public about these dilemmas and find the ways to do that. But what is something that you find is really key to making sure that those dilemmas internally within the company really rises to the surface, that they're not, because I think that's something, and I had a conversation with Frank Blake on the podcast before. He was the CEO of the Home Depot, a company with 500,000 employees, so it's also a large company. He talked about, and this was connected to customer service, but he said that so often we might say that we want to see customer service, but at the same time, what we generally measure is like the level of theft in stores. So we create kind of these dilemmas out, these tensions out within the company, but we don't really want to take responsibility for them or talk about them. What's something that you see as critical to making sure that the dilemmas, tensions rise up and that they're addressed in a good way?
You hit the point of the nail, Tobias. I mean, I think there is this intrinsic fear of not having a response as a leader, because the problem is ethical dilemmas don't have an easy answer. And, you know, in performance-driven organizations, and let's face it, I mean, business is and has to be a performance-driven organization. There is this intrinsic fear of leaders for not having a clear answer to a dilemma. So I'm not a behavioral scientist, but I learned a lot from the behavioral scientists in my team that we need to accept and look at the context where these discussions are taking place. Are we doing enough that the people are willing to share their dilemmas? Because even if we can't promise them a solution, we can listen, We can debate, we can balance the pros and cons of a difficult decision. And I give you a very practical example, because you said you wanted very practical. How do we start business meetings in companies? Normally, we go to the agenda, okay, first, financial numbers, second, revenue development, third, HR statistics. We should start, and we try to get this in with a reflection around the table. First 5-10 minutes. Could be an ethical dilemma. It could be the simple question around the table, how are you feeling today? I see you more silent. Anything you want to share, you can help. We do this in our executive committee with our CEO, Vas Narasimhan, every time. We start every executive committee with around the table. What's on your mind? Again, no perfection. This will also not help in every instance, but it creates a little bit more openness to put dilemmas on the table.
Great example. And I'll just say from my perspective, something that we do a lot with our clients and with executive teams is to encourage them to really ask themselves several questions and ask them in the what and where kind of form, to say, like, where have we acted in conflict with our values over this last week or last month? Or where have there been tensions and where have we succeeded in acting aligned? Like, but I really love that. And I think those reflections are so critical, and they're critical at every level of the company.
Absolutely, sure. And I think I read with great interest your 6 steps towards a culture in an organization. I think this resonates a lot. There's a role of leadership. There's the duty to make a kind of open atmosphere, to share topics, to be humble. So I think it has to be also a strategy. It doesn't come by itself immediately. So there has to be an atmosphere which is created intentionally in this way.
And when we talk about that atmosphere, what do you see as something that is really critical to creating that, to making sure that people actually feel that we are invited and welcome to talk about these things?
So of course, there's this famous tone from the top, not to have any misunderstanding. If this is not there, and this has to be an intrinsic one, not only on stage, forget it. I mean, always give the advice to colleagues who ask me, should I join this company? And then, look, have you talked to the CEO? Is this someone, she or he, who really takes this topic serious from the top? Is someone who delegates just ethics, compliance to the expert team? So this is here, but it has to go far beyond. We need to really get the people leaders involved, the famous middle management. It's a little bit of a strange description of this crucial importance of people who really lead on the front line, the people. If you're a newer, who gives you the example? Your direct manager, leader. You will look what she or he is doing, how they take ethics on board, yes or no. Are they listeners? Are they giving you advice? And then maybe something what we at the moment to be is what we are piloting, and it's super interesting. We go to the recruitment process. So we have included in our HR toolbox, when we ask candidates to apply for roles, we include ethical dilemmas. We ask them, how would you react in this situation? You get the sales target you believe you can't achieve. How would you react? And it's super interesting that people are used just to explain their CV and their professional expertise in the recruitment process to go beyond. So this is creating this kind of atmosphere that this really matters for the company.
100%. And I love that example, Klaus. That's a fantastic example of actually integrating ethical dilemmas in the interview process. Beautiful. And you've, at Novartis, you've taken an integrated approach where you bring together ethics, risk, and compliance. And I think this is really, really interesting. And of course, all of these really, really have to do with trust. How do we build, how do we sustain trust? And why do you think this approach is significant? And in what way does it differ from what you see as a more standard approach?
Yeah, I mean, if I reflect on my now more than 20 years in different industries and in the battlefield of ethics, risk, and compliance, I saw a lot of siloed approaches. Risk and compliance teams taking care of certain topics in the company in a siloed way, but there was no visibility. There was nothing connecting the dot. I mean, the famous example, anti-corruption work and human rights. I mean, this is intrinsically connected. If you have a supplier without playing according to the anti-corruption rules, potentially there's a human rights issue as well, health and safety issues, the way how you manage crises in companies, because we have combined enterprise risk management and crisis management. How do people react in crises? What can you learn how to react under pressure? We always have pressure in companies. I believe there is a huge lack in companies to put the things together. And this is what we, not perfect, don't get me wrong, we try to bring all the risk or the compliance function together on one platform horizontally and make ethics a tangible, what you said, a tangible practical topics. Because if it's only on the corporate homepage and the statement and esoteric, the people don't relate to this. It has to be linked to risk leadership, risk appetite. I mean, how you define your risk appetite in the company is basically an ethical question and defines your compliance program as well. So we truly believe this has all to move together.
And I love something that you said there, and that is we always have pressure in companies. I just think that sentence and that understanding, because I think so many times we want to create this thought or idea that, oh, but all is well, we don't have those issues here. But we always have pressure, and we have to learn, and we have to be, we have to be very intentional about how we deal with that pressure. And I'm very interested because you've spoken a lot, and I've listened to other interviews with you as well, where you talk about your learning from behavioral science. And just wanted to ask, what is something kind of critical that you've been learning, something that you've been starting to look at differently through studying behavioral science?
So I can tell you my biggest learning is my own biases I have, of course. It starts with me. My biggest bias is overconfidence. I believe I've seen it all, I know it all. And that's a leadership bias, overconfidence, hindsight bias. Very specific, because you asked for specific examples. I mean, learning, I want to call out as well our recent ethical survey. You know, we are doing ethics surveys in the company frequently. Is that leaders normally have the bias and they perceive they create an ethical environment. But if you ask their team members, they see it quite differently. So there's this bias of leaders. We can deal with pressure because we create an ethical environment where everyone can speak up. But on the receiving pressure side, well, leaders also have pressure. On the receiving side, the people say, no, I feel not able to speak up. I have my limitations. I have my concerns. And you have to go deep into this to really understand what's going on in your company.
I think there's so many important points there. And I'm reflecting on something, a study that Professor Anton Brunsell, I don't know if you're familiar with her, she's written a great book called Blind Spots. We have had an interview with her some years ago, but she has done this kind of experiment where she asks leaders, executives, MBAs to rate themselves on different like abilities. And there's a lot to say about that. Her conclusion is basically that we have positive illusions about a lot of different traits, like how good we are at decision-making and so on. But when it comes to our ethicality, we have hyper illusions. We think we are a lot more ethical than people are in general. And this relates to this. You write a great article on risk and compliance about how And you mentioned there how some companies are forced to put a compliance program in place after a misconduct scandal. And you use the analogy, which I love, which is when you suffer a severe road accident, you need immediate intensive care. But what comes after? I've worked with several organizations that have been addressing the cultural fallout of a scandal and also interviewed whistleblowers, ethics and compliance leaders who came in to kind of rectify situations. And I found that leaders have often been made aware of red flags and critical allegations much earlier, that there were signs there, but still often the leadership treated the issue like a PR problem. And we tried to do everything to protect the image of the organization as a good organization with great values. And I'm thinking about a conversation I had with Hiltrud Werner, who I'm sure you might know, who was recruited to head up legal and integrity in the wake of the emissions scandal as a member of the Volkswagen management board. And she told me on the podcast that at Volkswagen, when at that time, there was this too big to fail attitude. Why should we listen to the outside world? We are the benchmark. And how do you think that companies and a great company like Novartis, what can you do to kind of avoid this mentality? And as we've talked about kind of building in that value of humility and in our understanding of ourselves, both as managers and also as a company as a whole.
You mentioned a great word, humility, which is not really easy in companies and big corporations, to be honest. Also because companies are always under attack. And this is kind of, you know, natural defense. If I'm perceived to be weak or vulnerable, I will be attacked by social media, by unfriendly investors. And you have to understand this in a certain way, a natural need also an intrinsic, I mean, belief and need to defend the company and we will get it managed and too big to fail, all the things. I think one thing is super important is to better listen and then to react in companies. I'll give you one example. I mean, many companies are now stating we are getting data, we do surveys, we listen to the employees, what the issues are. I always say, great, and then ask a second question, what are you doing once you have the data and the readout? So what are you doing? Because to my belief, there is no survey fatigue in organization. There's an unhappiness or a really problem if the people don't see any reaction after a survey. I told my story and no one follows up. And I think what companies need to do is to act on these issues. And this is true for red flags. This is true for concerning outcomes of surveys. There are always one. I'll give you one example again. In our, not the last, but the survey before, we had a clear signal that our colleagues are still in fear of retaliation, which I understand. So we said, okay, take a new retaliation policy. We train this, we do roundtables, we make this a topic. Not perfect, but at least we try to showcase, we have listened, we understand, and the company is trying to do the best what they can, not perfect, to respond to your concerns. So this kind of listening and then acting, I think this can give you a better intelligence what's really going on and where the real risk is in your organization.
You raised something so incredibly important there. And I think that bears repeating that people are not generally tired of answering surveys, but they're tired of answering things where they feel like we don't do something about it. And that's, of course, also one of the kind of the rationalizations when we reflect on, should I speak up? And one of the key questions everyone asks themselves internally in their processing is, will it make a difference? And if I can tell myself that it's not going to make a difference, why in the world should I bother, especially if it is uncomfortable? And you took this example of retaliation. And if we would look at that in a company like yours, and of course, like you said before, yes, tone from the top matters. But again, most people within the company will not be afraid of being retaliated against by or from the CEO. I mean, it's of course somebody, a manager more in their proximity or a colleague, so someone else. Like, so what are some things when you look at making that shift? Because of course, I think that's a cultural shift. It might be a different shift as well. It might be processes and so on. But what do you see as critical to driving that change? What are some things that you've been working with at Novartis?
Yeah. I mean, at the beginning of our dialogue, you said this is a global company and you're in so many countries. So it's very interesting because, yes, that's all true. So we have this dilemma to have one brand, the one Novartis, but we have 80,000 people working in so many countries. And it's not an easygoing email by the CEO to all employees, but we have to go it is to look at the local context and to go deep. So what we try to do when we get out the data of the ethics survey, we slice and dice this to the local content. And we provide our local ethics risk and compliance teams with the results, a clear ask, do local workshops, go to the manufacturing sites, go to the offices, meet the people, try to see how they would answer on the challenges of the survey. What can we do? What are proposals? Of course, get the local management also in as well. That's important. But there's a lot of work, to be honest. I mean, the data we have, and I think many companies have the data, and then you have to do the work, which needs also, by the way, resources and budget. I mean, let's face this. And I still believe many companies make it too easy to say, we're an ethical company, we're doing all. But if you ask, okay, is your ethics, risk, compliance department well enough resourced? Do we have budget to do these things? It's a big silence. So walk the talk. You also have to have the people to do the follow-up and to go deep in the local context.
I think connected to what you say, you are an ethical company until suddenly you aren't. And of course, suddenly something happens. And that's the issue. If you're not really building towards that, like you said, and I think that is such an important part or such an important insight and understanding that people are fallible, we're flawed. We can make mistakes, and we all do, and that's not necessarily bad, but we can also all end up in situations, in circumstances, in contexts that might drive us to do things that are unethical. And I think it's so important as well what you're saying with really the local context. And I think that's also where we can simplify or be really naive about culture and just think that, oh, it's just that we promote this message. But as you say, in a company like Novartis, you have so many different subcultures. And connected to that, you've been developing a new code of ethics at Novartis. And of course, I think so many times people are really accustomed to code of conduct or value statement to feel more like that kind of paper that, you know, that you go through at the introduction and perhaps once a year or something, somebody's going to talk about it. But it's not really something that is culture, the work environment at the organization, even though so many companies claim that on their website. What do you think is really critical to, and what's been important to you in the process of creating your code of ethics and also in the integration of it? And of course, we could spend hours talking about that, but what are some of the highlights that you think are important to reflect on?
I would say, first of all, you have to be clear what this code should be. And for me, it's the constitution of the company. And you have to agree on this, that this is the constitution of the company. And if you don't get this buy-in from the leadership, you better don't start to develop something big because there has to be a joint understanding. That's mad. It's a constitution. It marks the values of our company. And then I think don't develop this in the corporate ivory tower. And it's possible these days, crowdsource, user towns. Get people in real voices from the local context, what matters to them most. We saw it when we did it, the topics like diversity and inclusion, a top issue, fair, respectful treatment. Of course, there's anti-corruption, anti-trust. We all know this, but what really moves the people, how they want to be treated and worked, and then put this into a context, the code itself will always be somehow a document, but we tried to put this into an ecosystem where you can check your biases, where you can try to get support from colleagues directly on a platform you can connect with, where there's a toolbox of ethical dilemmas you can use for your business meetings. We try to make this a workable product for your daily life in the company.
Something I reflect on when you talked about this is this, I think so many times we make this division between, if we would say, the compliance ethics topics and then more kind of HR topics. So we would say respectful environment, diversity and so on, which would be more of an HR topic. But I think what we're seeing, I think in the research that I'm looking at, and is that these things are very interconnected. That I mean, of course, respect is an ethics question and diversity is also an ethics question in that perspective. And I think do we sometimes, and would love to hear your perspective on this, do we sometimes create too much division between these different topics and also what is kind of on HR's table and what is on ethics and compliance and, of course, other functions? I think generally that we have a problem that we delegate all these issues to other functions and we don't see it as a top management issue because I think it should be. But yeah, what's your perspective?
Yeah, this is the famous silos we have in companies. And this is, I can only repeat this. For me, one of the biggest risks for a cultural, really meaningful advancement and building trust. Because if you keep these topics in silos, and companies are naturally built in silos, as the HR department, as the compliance department, as the legal department. I mean, a classical example is, you know, the strategy and risk departments never talk to each other, don't like each other. Strategy people don't like risk people and vice versa. But strategy without proper risk management and risk management without strategy doesn't make any sense. We brought the departments together to do the workshops together, to talk to each other and to do it together. And the same is true what you said to me, as it's for HR, people topics. And the ethics and compliance topics, this is the same. But I will not underestimate the efforts and the difficulties you have, because overcoming silos in big organization is super difficult. We have just have to acknowledge this.
Is there something that you've learned in your work that has been helpful to overcome those silos?
So maybe that's a disappointing answer for you. It's a very formal answer, but I would say it helps definitely. If the positions, as I'm in, for example, are members of the top executive committee, of the top leadership of the company, because if the ethics and compliance people are subordinated to legal or down in the organization, I mean, how can you blame them not to be able to be a catalyst? And we all need to be catalysts. As you said, we're not owning ethics. We can be a catalyst to put things on the table, to structure a process towards a code of ethics. So there has to be, I believe, more acknowledgement. And therefore, I'm fighting so much for this ethics and integrated assurance to position these topics on the agenda of the company high enough, because only then you have the impact and the resources and the budget in the company to foster true collaboration to get to things done. Maybe a little bit formalistic answer, but that's, I believe, reality.
No, it's really, really, really helpful answer. I think so, absolutely, too. And I think there's incredible power when you see HR and ethics and compliance really collaborating. And I mean, because I've tried to put words on this for quite some time, and the way that I've done it is to think that, of course, my focus is very much around culture. So I think that cultural health or a healthy culture enables an organization to deliver on its mission and strategy, to build a thriving workplace and to have a responsible impact. And I see all those things as very interconnected. And I see trust as very central, because when you look at trust, or these are all central to trust, because trust has to do with our competence to deliver, but it has to do in equal measures of our, whether we are seen as ethical, whether we're seen as living the values that we profess.
Yeah, I fully agree. And you know this as an expert and professional in the field, the BS that this is not done overnight. So always mistrust companies who say after a scandal or a downgrade or whatever, 1 week later, we are a different company, we have changed everything, we have a better culture now. This, I mean, it's often a painful journey because you have setbacks, not everything works. To be honest, what you do, you have to experiment in a certain way, and something resonates more, other resonates less, but keep on trying to do it.
I think what you're saying is so important, that it is not a goal. And I think that's also an issue, that we see culture as a project, but culture is not a project. I mean, it's not, or ethics, it's not a project. It's not something you can tick off the list. It is this continual work. And I use the picture of our physical health, because I think it is a good picture to think our physical health, it is built by our consistent habits. It's built, I might have done well for 5 years, but my decisions today my decisions now will impact my health. And the same is true of our organizations. And there I see that habits are so critical. What are the habits that our leaders have? What is it that because we as organizations become what we repeatedly do, just as people become what they repeatedly do. So I normally ask this question on the podcast: what is something that you see as critical habits for leaders to have and that you really want to instill in managers across all levels at Novartis to really help build this ethical across the company?
Be two things for many which you could discuss, but I think what is essential to bring this cultural leadership to all levels in the organization. I mean, our CEO Vasi, he once created this word of unbossed leaders, which was misunderstood many years because the people thought, well, unbossed leader, does this mean I don't need to, do my work or whatever? No, it just means to give the people the clarity what to do, but then also the accountability to do it, and by the way, in an ethical way. So I think this is a topic which we try, and we have not achieved it fully, I would say, to bring this to all levels of the organization, because it's a difficult concept. And second, look, there are very difficult taboo issues in our companies. The issues you normally don't want to touch. I'll give you one practical example. I think there is no perfect incentive structure in companies which is fully matching to your ethics program. It's super difficult because we are profit-driven companies. That's why we're existing. We have 9 billion budget for research and development, which in pharma, you never know. It can go the last day. It can go wrong and you lost all your investment on a 10 years clinical development. And this is all, it's all gone. So you need, but to link, that's the eternal question. Are we able to discuss at least, and we discuss incentives for all levels of the organization? It starts with the CEO, of course, but it goes down to the sales leaders in the countries. Are we at least able that this is linked somehow to our values and behaviors we want to achieve in a sound and healthy, I like the word, by the way, culture? Or is this a taboo topic in the company no one wants to touch because it's too difficult and too dangerous? That's one example, maybe.
Great example. And I know for all ethics and compliance leaders who are listening to this conversation, I'm sure you have similar struggles because, of course, when it comes to incentives, that those are really tricky and you want to drive it. I could just recommend we have a great conversation on the podcast with Uri Gnisi, who's this fantastic expert on incentives. But I wanted to connect back with something you said earlier, and I think that was so powerful, and that's the idea of the code of ethics as the constitution. And when we think about the constitution, and now, of course, I directly think about the US constitution. And so you have this document, you have something that is foundational, something that you say, this is what we should adhere to. But at the same time, it is not necessarily 100% clear what that should look like in practice all the time. And you have this constant debate of, so what does the constitution, what does that actually mean when we apply it in our current reality or in this, on this current dilemma? And maybe that's the thing as well, that that's actually what a good code of ethics should do, or company values should do, is that they should help create those robust conversations, and where you say where nothing should be off limits, where we have to be able to discuss everything, but we also need to be okay that it's not that simple, that it's not that clear cut, that we can't just say, oh, but this is the ethical way to do things, or but we have to have those robust conversations and we have to facilitate them.
Yeah, I like this challenge, to be honest, because it forces us out of our comfort zone, coming from a classical compliance approach, which is compliance with the laws, which is not sufficient anymore. I mean, compliance with laws is difficult enough, trust me. I have enough cars myself there, but it's not enough for fostering a good reputation and trust, as you said. It has to go beyond. And look, a good constitution goes beyond the law, because a constitution needs to unite a country, the people, the citizens. It has to speak to the heart as well. It's more than a law, you know. It has to be something foundational, as you just said, to be it. So this is the challenge. I would just ask all heads of compliance or heads of ethics or integrity out there, called, if you have the chance to create a new code, take it as something special. That's a once-in-a-lifetime chance to do something really foundational for the company. And I think it's a fun and really rewarding challenge for our profession as well.
I'm wondering, based on that, we've developed something we call the Culture and Leadership Program, and just reflecting on what is it that really makes a difference. And something that I think is that so many times when we talk about codes of ethics or codes of conduct or value statements and so on, it becomes this almost, we're standing from above teaching people how to behave. And what I'm thinking is what we really want to do, which is harder, because we can say from the other perspective, okay, we've done this amount of trainings with this amount of people, they've gone through it, they've learned it. But from the other perspective, we kind of want to develop the kind of professional judgment of our team members. We want them to become more reflective. We want them to actually, in my perspective, to have rituals of reflecting on their behavior, reflecting on their decisions, and for leaders to reflect on their leadership and actually make a practice of that. That we want them, that it's okay, that it's, we're not saying exactly how everything should be done. Just like you said, it is that constant conversation. What is the way that you're trying to facilitate that at Novartis?
Make it very personal. And It's maybe only a small piece, a mosaic piece to be as, but when we are just launching out a second edition of the Code of Ethics, and what we bring in there are personal commitments in quotes by colleagues. So what does the code mean for you? Very much, what does the code mean for you? So you will see next to the principles, the commitments we have and why they're important for the company, you will see personal commitments from all over the globe. What this for me in Brazil, in China, in Russia, in Germany, in Switzerland, in Sweden, what does this mean for me as Klaus, as a member of this company? Because then if it becomes personal, you will not forget it and you will have a better chance to consider your decision. You pause, reflect, consider your decision based on the ethical principle. We have to make it personal.
Beautiful. Personal, Christian. You are leading this large team. You have a huge, huge team. You're working in this global company. How do you keep it together, Klaus?
How do you keep it together? I mean, for me, you know, I'm basically an optimist. You know, despite all the poorly crises we see and the risk mentioned and the crises, because I believe in the power of a team and of people, and fun plays an important role. I mean, we also have to create this as an issue which also motivates the people, positive engagement. If you overcome a crisis, if you manage a crisis, if you discuss an ethical dilemma, this should be also an intellectual and a fun exercise. And I see more and more people buying in my, I mean, we have moved far away from a legalistic way how to handle this. We have good lawyers in the organization. Myself, I'm by education lawyer, but 90% of the colleagues I have in ethics, risk and compliance are coming from all different places. Human resources, sales, procurement, research development, everywhere. And this diversity in thinking is hugely rewarding from a leadership point of view.
Beautiful. Klaus, this has been a fantastic conversation. I'm so grateful that you were willing to take the time. And I wanted to end by just asking you, how can our listeners connect with you and follow your work?
That's very kind, and I mutually really enjoyed our dialogue. And I learned, again, a lot from your stepwise approach towards a good culture and companies. Look, I share maybe more than others a lot on social media, on LinkedIn. Basically, on my profile, you will find the articles from country visits. I normally report from country visits because I believe when I meet people, I want to showcase what I have seen. For my international engagements in various platforms, OECD or elsewhere. So connect with me on LinkedIn and you will see where we are up to.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Klaus.
Thank you, Tobias. It was great fun.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, it really means the world to us if you would share, rate, and review it on iTunes. We're super grateful for all the 5-star reviews and generous comments that we received so far. It really helps us take the message of purpose and integrity to a wider audience. And finally, don't forget to grab your free PDF on leadingtransformationalchange.com. See you in 2 weeks.